Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Today we report from Madrid's Fashion Week and ask the question, is enough being done for the Spanish fashion scene?
We now understand that because of internet or whatever, we are not just in Spain, we're exposed to the rest of the world. And now if we want to make something stand out and be really special, we really have to work hard.
With a new director in tow, we ask if the event can be revived and if the Spanish capital can really rival the popular sister shows held in Paris, New York, Milan and London. Next.
Houses are becoming unaffordable. It makes very good sense to accelerate the pace of apartment building, but it has to be done well. And most apartments are done very badly.
We sit down with architecture writer Michael Webb to find out why new apartment buildings are what our cities need most. And finally, we thumb through a new book from Chilean music producer Nicolas Jarre that blurs the boundaries between sound and graphic design. We speak to his collaborators to find out more. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. As a bullish new generation of young Spanish fashion designers take their battle for recognition abroad, many in the industry are beginning to raise their voices about the changes needed at home. Now, Madrid Fashion Week wrapped up last Tuesday, but did anyone really notice the show go? That's the challenge facing the event's new director, Charo Izquierdo, whose predecessor held his position for 31 years straight before bowing out to make room for a little much-needed change. Our correspondent Liam Aldous spent a few days with the designers, relaying their recommendations back to the new director, always with one of his own in mind, though, how to fix Madrid's Fashion Week.
When you go outside, people appreciate your work, but I don't know why it still gets hard to people to know that Fashion Week exists here.
The fact that Madrid Fashion Week takes place on the same dates as London Fashion Week is a big problem for Spanish fashion. No one, it seems, is paying much attention. For years, the event has been a self-perpetuated echo chamber, with designers often debuting their collections for friends and family rather than foreign media. But this isn't the only problem, as we're about to find out. That strained voice you heard before belongs to promising young designer Pepa Salazar. I speak to her just moments after her runway show at Madrid's Off Fashion Week event. The main event, held in a government-funded fairground out near the airport, stagnated under the 31-year tenure of the former director. The Off event, however, has thrived. This is where you find Madrid's fresh class of daring designers. And who better to ask about how to fix Madrid Fashion Week?
The first time I showed at Paris, just in the trade show, I get open ceremony as one of my sales points. So it was really good for me and for my work to be able to be in such a big store in New York, LA, and the website. So I think it's really important for people from Spain to go outside and try to show the work. The thing we are missing here is the figure of the buyer. Not the fashion people, because we have a lot. So to do a show here is worth it, but not to have a trade show because we don't have buyers.
The next day I make the long journey to Efema, Madrid's fairground, where a wonderland of sponsors, teenage girls, and an army of frenetic fashion industry staffers are readying the next runway. This venue is widely criticised. It's not just the distance, it's also just a very uninspiring industrial pavilion. But more about that in a bit. Spotting new director Charo Izquierdo on the sidelines of a show, I cite some of Pepa's concerns to her directly.
I was actually talking to a designer in Off Fashion Week last night, and she said for her the biggest problem in Madrid is that the buyers don't come. Is there a strategy to try and change that?
Yes, and actually we have two buyers here on Fashion Week, and they are astonished with the level of the designers. I think that they want absolutely bring Spanish designers to LATAM and also to Hong Kong.
To her credit, Charo has only been in the job for a few months and hasn't had time to crack open the Madrid echo chamber. Two foreign buyers are surely better than none, but still not nearly enough. However, there's another sticking point. No foreign press, perhaps scared off by strict press accreditation rules. I relay a story to Charo about a French fashion journalist who didn't make it to Madrid this February because she was told by Efema that accreditations closed in December.
I can't believe it.
So, I mean, that's obviously a problem, no?
It's really a problem. Did you have the same problem last year?
Yeah, I had the same problem.
It's stupid,
okay,
yes. Having hired journalists as director is interesting because I know better how to communicate. There are things that have to be changed. I didn't know about that problem. And thank you for talking to me about
it. It's Saturday night and I'm back on the sidelines of the OFF event to see Palomo Spain, the young label that transcends gender, couture and Spanish motifs to such high acclaim that this year, designer Alejandro Gómez Palomo was invited to show at New York Fashion Week.
I've been the one who's always talking about making a change in Spain and try to do something different without being scared of, you know, being in a small country where fashion isn't relevant at all. There's a huge difference from showing in here to showing in New York because the window you're exposed to is much wider. So, of course, you show in New York, everyone's looking at you already. And if you're me, then they're looking more. Just people getting to understand what I do and getting to know who I am and seeing that I'm actually ready to take over the fashion world. And, you know, I'm serious about what I do and I'm here to conquer your heart.
Alejandro doesn't know it yet, but a few days after this interview, he will be the first Spaniard nominated for the coveted LVMH Fashion Prize. Not bad for a 24-year-old designer who put on his first runway show just 12 months ago.
No, I don't want to be like the messiah. I've done whatever I wanted to do whenever I wanted to do, and that made the difference. I think people should take themselves a bit more serious and do whatever they feel is right and fight for it.
Can we just go here 1 second?
Yeah.
So we just escaped a room where there's not as much techno noise. Tell me, how would you describe the younger generation of Spanish designers? What makes them different from the older designers, which most of who are showing in Efema and Madrid Fashion Week official?
I think we now understand that because of internet or whatever, we are not just in Spain, we're exposed to the rest of the world. And now if we want to make something, you know, stand out and be really special, we really have to work hard.
It's day three, and Anna Locking, a label that has become increasingly international during the crisis, has just shown her latest collection. My question to her is pretty straightforward. Why show in Madrid at all?
I need very good pictures and a video, etc., to go abroad and show my clients, and they see that I'm a strong label. That season after season, I create a show and I show to the people my work in the catwalk. This is important, but it's very important too where you create your catwalk, your show.
Spanish designers know they're on the periphery and need to take their fight directly to the fashion capitals to re-show their work. The public money staging these elaborate runway productions here in Madrid is a huge help, but ultimately, it's a pretty hefty price tag just to produce some photos and video.
There is one big thing that even the casting is sponsored. We have the best casting almost in the world and for almost zero. So that's like the big value that we can produce like the best pictures, the best set.
Victor Alonso is half of dynamic design duo Maria Ke Fisherman, which forms part of the official program, but for many, they're the odd label out. So why are they here?
We are a small team and we can't handle a production, a big production in New York or in Paris or in London. And we prefer like to focus in the product than in the way to show it. We have been in New York Fashion Week twice, but now we feel like here we are much more comfortable. We have our own team, all our whole team here. In Spain, there are not too many people that think like us, so there is only like a 10% of sales here in Spain, and the other remaining, it's in the whole world, like in capitals like New York, San Francisco, LA, Tokyo, Shanghai, and this is our big market.
And how did you achieve that as a designer, a Spanish designer who wants to get 90% sales, foreign sales? That's a big achievement. How did you manage to do that?
I think that making our own product that fits in this kind of avant-garde markets, that the thing that made us like to reach the right people, like the important stylists, main stylists of celebrities, like this Rihanna, Lady Gaga, these people, yes.
Victor, like every other designer I've spoken to, is also adamant that Madrid's Fashion Week needs to live and breathe the city's creative spirit. Right now, the event seems prisoner to public money, a proposition which I put to the new director at the end of day three.
When I was a journalist, I thought it's a pity don't move to the center. Now, I know that it's very difficult to move to the center. I don't say it's not possible, but it's very difficult and it's very expensive. And it's necessary to find someone paying that.
There are plenty of sponsors, though. In 2017, the question is how to rework the current model to make Madrid Fashion Week less of a party and more of a commercial platform for the designers. Changing the dates and diversifying the locations could make Madrid more of a destination. But in fashion's digital age, this is also a question of attention. If a collection is shown on this runway and the world isn't watching, not even online, will anyone ever wear it?
I'm working long term. Well, it's very important September, but for me it's the big picture. I'm working in a big picture.
Yeah, I can see the weight of responsibility coming over the expression of your face.
Really?
Yeah. You're really thinking well into the future. Well, good luck.
Thank you very much.
Monocle's always dapper man in Madrid, Liam Aldous there, reporting from the Spanish capital's Fashion Week, which wrapped up last Tuesday. More and better apartments are our only hope to counter the housing shortage in our cities, says LA-based architecture writer Michael Webb. And his new book, Building Community, New Apartment Architecture, provides a wealth of benchmarks in that regard. The title explores 30 projects from around the globe and explains why each works so well. Michael spoke on the phone to our producer, Henry Rhys Sheridan, and began by explaining what building a community means for designers.
I was inspired by the apartment that I've lived in for the last 40 years in Los Angeles that was built in 1937 by Richard Neutra. And Charles and Ray Eames lived here through the 1940s, and they were very demanding, and they wrote to Neutra to say how much they'd enjoyed the combination of privacy and also a feeling that they were part of a larger whole. And for me, my neighbors, I live alone, my neighbors are my family. I meet them when I want to. They aren't in my face, they aren't living with me, but they are there if I need them, either for dinner or for an emergency. And it seems to me that that was an ideal way to live. I don't want to be in a house, you know, set off somewhere by itself. And I wouldn't know what to do with all that space. I think people can live happily in much smaller spaces than they think. And out of this came another apartment building, which is right across the street, designed by a very good architect, Lorcan O'Herlihy, which does exactly the same thing for a very different demographic, mostly students. It's very close to UCLA. So the combination of those two, the old one and the new one, and the way they balance privacy and community was really the seed for the book.
In the introduction to the book, you write that there's an urgent need to build many more apartments. Why?
Many more and much better. Because more and more people are moving to cities, land is in very short supply, prices are shooting up in major cities like London, Paris, New York, San Francisco, and now even Los Angeles. Houses are becoming unaffordable. And as I said, a lot of people don't need houses. You don't have a family. You don't need, 5,000 square feet of space. You can live very happily in half that or less than half if it's well planned and have many of the same advantages of a house with much less maintenance and much less overhead. And so from an economic standpoint, and in terms of bringing people closer together and densifying cities and making them more exciting, more vibrant, as against the dispersal of living spaces in suburbia, it makes very good sense to accelerate the pace of apartment building, but it has to be done well, and most apartments are done very badly.
Your book is trying to showcase some of the best examples of apartment buildings. Tell me about a few of your favourites and why you think they're exemplary.
One that I would love to live in, I think, is Tietgen in Copenhagen. It's a cylindrical building with like a hollow wheel and has, I think, around 400 units with communal kitchens. This is if I were a student again. I think it would be a little too communal probably for me now, but it brings a group of 10 single units together in a shared space. And it then opens onto a landscaped courtyard. So it has, again, the privacy of a single room, the small community of 10 people all cooking for each other and hanging out, and the larger community of 400 that will be in the courtyard. That's, I think, a model of how student housing could be done. Another scale entirely is Eighthouse, also in Copenhagen. Interesting that three of the examples in the book are from Denmark. Eighthouse is by Big, Bjarke Ingels, who is now taking New York by storm. And this is a figure eight, a courtyard, tilts down, gives everybody a view over the water and the landscape, has a ramp that wraps up around the inner the courtyard in order to bring everybody up the one way, rather like a pedestrian street. And again, a wonderful way of creating a vibrant community within the city. Those are two, but there are many, many others. And what I particularly emphasize in the book is the fact that they're all price points. Far too much effort goes into building so-called luxury apartments, which very often aren't particularly luxurious, for billionaires. And that is not where the greatest demand lies, as people often have three or four houses to choose from. It's the people who are living in very poor accommodations or way out in the suburbs who'd like to come and live in the city who really need an affordable place to live.
So you've mentioned, and you mentioned in the book, that the standard of apartment architecture thus far has been quite low. Why has that been the case?
For a simple reason, the whole production of houses has been turned over to private developers who are beholden to investors who want a quick return on their money. So they stick to a safe, marketable formula, essentially grinding out apartments that are like motels or shopping malls. They're absolutely standardized, generic, have no frills, are pared to the bone, cheaply made. No shared space because that's not bringing in any income. And as long as the demand continues at the level it is now, they can get away with doing that. People don't have choices. People have to settle for something that they really wouldn't like to live in if they had a choice, but have no choice because the better quality are unaffordable. In the book, I talk about apartment buildings going back to the early years of the 20th century and how over that period of time, in Paris, in Berlin, in England, there has been a wonderfully enlightened attitude toward planning apartments. Now, unfortunately, that has gone away, and that is why there is no contemporary British example.
And all things taken into account, are you optimistic that there will be an improvement in apartment building quality in the near future?
Not without a revolution, no. I think that the privatization of apartment building isn't going to change overnight. There are a few enlightened developers. The one that built the building across the street was persuaded that it would be smarter to do a well-designed than a badly designed building. But it took a lot of arm twisting, indeed a lawsuit, to bring him to that point. I know a few who really care passionately about the quality of what they do, hire the best architects and challenge them to do very well-planned, well-landscaped buildings with generous shared space on the same budget as the people who are doing bad work. It doesn't necessarily cost more, and the purpose of the book is to show how at every price point it can be done well, but how seldom that is the case.
Michael Webb there with his new book, Building Community, New Apartment Architecture, which is published by Thames and Hudson and available now. In August 2016, Chilean music producer Nicolas Jarre launched the online sound art project Other People Network. The platform includes 111 radio channels which play sounds and music across a galaxy of genres. The conceptual project originated from a radio play that was once rejected by the BBC. Designers Jenna Myung and Mazia Palavan were drafted to make posters for each of the stations. Now their work is being preserved in a book marking the culmination of the project, which has been produced by New York art publisher Printed Matter. To find out more, Monocle's Ed Stocker invited Jenna and Muzia to our New York bureau to discuss the project. Jenna began by talking about her relationship to sound from the perspective of a designer.
I've never worked with any like sound projects. I'd actually just graduated, so this was kind of the first independent project I've done out of school. But in school, I think a reoccurring theme was like going back to sound, and I think I didn't realize that until I had like three projects all related to like some music or like any other sound related topic. So I think it was just also a natural progression and a natural like inclination to do more work that had sound in the background.
And how do you translate something that obviously has those sound elements into a book? How do you move to that medium?
We like the idea of kind of taking the entirety of the project and it's split into thirds and it had like three different kind of content, and we just kind of made the book in a very like loose structural way where it just weaves out in and out of like sound, like transcriptions and also visual stuff that we made for each station, and then also these like added essays that are written by other people. So I think like in that aspect, very much like a radio, it kind of just came in and out of these like different components of what makes up a radio. So I think it was very straightforward and easy for us.
Mazia, maybe you can talk to us about how much of a vision Nico had for what he wanted, or whether it was more that he had some ideas but then really gave you free rein to develop and come up, both of you, with your own visual identity for this project.
He had some clear ideas about his project as a composer. We had some conversation because he already got to know our visual work, so he had an idea what it would look like. But we also, me and Jenna, had also freedom to kind of form the look of it. We had some conversation with Nico, but our ideal was kind of the same.
Jenna, give me an idea of the mind of Nico and kind of translating that onto the pages of a book. You mentioned earlier about this book being divided into thirds. There's this, I don't know if fixation is the right word, but this multiples of three, a recurring theme of the project. So maybe you can just explain to listeners about the particularities of this and how you kind of got that onto page.
I think the number 333 or something, you know, multiple, something that was divided always into thirds was Nico's idea from the way beginning of the project. And I think for him, it's just a very significant and very strong number. You know, when you go into the site where the radio is shown, every station lands on a multiple of thirds. When we're starting to design the book is not just divided into three perfect sections, but it has three different kinds of content that, you know, you weave in and out of, as I mentioned earlier. We decided that was just a more natural way to structure the whole book. And also, there were some like graphic elements that we carried out this idea of three as well, like the IC2 on the cover. It's very graphic and you might not first realize it's the letter I. And, you know, everything is broken up into thirds. There's like nine I's and three C's and so on. And then we have this like grid of three numbers on the foredge. So I think it's just a very significant number that played out well graphically.
Mazia, maybe you want to add something about that too.
Sure. I think three is kind of a working number in general. And I think in different practices, you kind of see Swiss design three kind of makes it easy to kind of do the design. But also for me, there was something in common in my work that there's three also I use a lot. And I think for me, it came from the psychoanalysis practice I'm interested in. And then later on, I realized that Nico also kind of liked analyzing things through dividing them in three parts and kind of try to see something from different angles.
On this project, was there anything that was new, anything that you hadn't done design-wise?
Yeah, I think it was amazing how productive we had to be. There was a lot of things, and I think at some point for me, like, I had to decide, okay, this is like 100 posters. You can't just sit. So there was also a kind of progress through the process. I think the process was amazing for me and kind of very productive. And I kind of reached my borders in, let's say, playing with type. I had to make a lot of decisions that in the end had to have a kind of repertoire somehow that it wouldn't be boring or kind of the same. So I had to kind of try everything.
And as designers, how important do you think it is that someone who's an artist, you know, with the background in music is kind of taking this beyond the boundaries of music and kind of evolving it and incorporating elements like design into a project? Would you like to see more people do that? How important do you think it is for the arts generally?
For me, it's maybe the best way to kind of combine different practices. It's been a lot of between genres, and I think most of them are great.
What would you say, Jenna?
I would have to agree. I think the combining and learning from different practices and how people who do different things that you don't, how they see your practice is how probably you learn the most, or learn like a different perspective that if you know you wouldn't get if you just talk to other designers. I just like love the whole experience of seeing how Nico works regarding with Orne Music and also how he worked in graphic design. It was pretty just eye-opening coming from talking to other designers. So I would love to see that happen more.
Designers Jenna Myung and Mazia Palavan there speaking about Network, a new book documenting their collaboration with Chilean music producer Nicholas Jar. Network is published by Printed Matter and available for pre-order now at printedmatter.org. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My very special thanks to our ever-patient editor, Alex Funnell, the man behind the glass, Wei Donglin, and this show's producer, the one and only Henry Rees-Sheridan. If you have any comments or queries, then do feel free to drop Henry a note at hrs@monocle.com. And remember that we're back at the self-same time next week. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes, wherever you find your podcasts. And please do leave us a review on iTunes. It really does help people find the show. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett. Until next time, thank you very much and goodbye.